Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and assistant editor Lee Boyce is assistant personal finance editor Helen Crane. And coming up, with inflation on the rise, homeowners nearing the end of their mortgage deals are being urged to lock in. So do you go for 2, 5, or even 10 years? But then again, are trackers so bad? Meanwhile, the buy-to-let bonanza. Landlords can now bag a sub 1% mortgage rate, but beware the fees. House prices are rising at the fastest rate since the housing boom of 2007, with the race for space also hitting rural renters. Also today, should I sell my old premium bonds and buy a new set? Lockdown savers pile into fairly easy access and fancy a career change? How about becoming an HGV driver? Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, the governor of the Bank of England has been warning that interest rates could be raised if higher inflation sticks around. The result is that mortgages could get more expensive. With the squeeze already well and truly on households at the moment, homeowners being urged to lock into a new fixed rate loan and protect their finances. So, do you opt for a 2, a 5, or even a 10-year deal? Helen, with mortgage rates so low at the moment, honestly, it feels like every day there's a new lower rate coming out. Is this fear really realistic?
Yeah, so as you say, mortgage rates are incredibly low at the moment, where we're seeing things as low as 0.78%, which are historic lows. That's been going on for some time. Since the end of the lockdowns last summer, mortgage rates have gradually been coming down and down and down. I think we are probably hitting a floor with how low they will go. But aside from that, as you say, it all depends really on what happens to the base rate. So if that rises, which Andrew Bailey has said it probably will, and possibly even before the end of the year, then mortgage rates will start to go up. So I think if you're coming to the end of a fixed mortgage deal, it's definitely a good time to lock in a rate now, because they are only going one way and possibly sooner rather than later.
Question is, though, do you fix to a fix? There's a better way of putting this, I'm sure of it. Or fix to a tracker? I say that because of Yorkshire Building Society's offering.
Yeah, that's right. So Yorkshire Building Society have come out with a 0.78% rate this week, which is very, very low, but that is a tracker. So it tracks the base rate above a certain percentage. So the rate you would have now is 0.78%, but really that is the Bank of England base rate, which is 0.1% plus 0.68%. So if the base rate goes up, then your monthly payments will also go up. It doesn't sound like a very good idea for most people at the moment, given that the base rate is probably going to go up. The reason that you might take a tracker is because they're more flexible than a fixed rate. So normally, if you want to overpay, the fees are lower. If you want to repay your mortgage early, I think the fee for early repayments on this one is 1% of the total mortgage amount if you repay within the fixed period. So that's about half what you would pay if you were on a standard fixed rate. So it's a bit more flexible, but it certainly isn't something that's going to work for everyone.
Saying that, though, I mean, 0.78, even if it went up to 0.2, the base rate, 0.25, that's still not high, is it? I mean, how high are we expecting the Bank of England to go? Because all indications so far suggest it's not going to go at a fair clip, Lee.
Yeah, you're right there, Georgie. I mean, the thing is, realistically, if base rate is risen, if it goes up, it's only going to go up a smidgen. You'd imagine it would be 0.25%. I'd find it quite hard to believe that it'd go up to 0.5% very quickly. But it's like crystal ball gazing, isn't it? I don't have the answers to that. We don't have the answers to that. And we're saying, you know, there's hints that base rate may go up before Christmas because of runaway inflation, but you know, it's still just so volatile and difficult to predict what will happen. And that is the very nature of a tracker and having a tracker mortgage. It's the kind of risk that you're taking there, and that's why especially in recent years, fixed rates have just become such a popular product for home buyers. And actually, not just fixed rates, but five-year fixes have kind of become the dominant type of mortgage product for people to take out. And that's because on the whole, people like the kind of stability of knowing what their mortgage payment is going to be every month for 5 years, you know, 60 months. That's quite a long time. And when you buy a house, time actually does just fly. You know, I remember taking out a 2-year fix when I first bought a home, and before I knew it, I was remortgaging. You know, it just happens so quickly. It was just so fast. And I think a lot of people find themselves in that boat, but there's a lot of things to consider. And I always say that a good broker is really worth their weight in gold. I really do believe that brokers, you know, can help people get their heads around what really is the best product for you. And there's a lot of things and things that you need to consider. So firstly, things like fees. So while the headline rate on that Yorkshire deal is good, that tracker deal, the fee is quite hefty on it. And actually that makes it not as appealing as the headline rate suggests. So you need to factor in all of the fees, you know, and the overall cost of the mortgage. That's one thing. Early repayment charges. If you are having a 5-year fix, quite often a lender will have like a sliding scale of early repayment charge. So what I mean by that is like first year it might be 5%, second year it might be 4%, then it might be 3, 2, 1. And that's going to penalize you if circumstances change. And that the other thing to then make sure that it's important is whether you can port that mortgage. So if you get a 5-year fix, what's the likelihood of you moving within that 5-year period? And can you port that mortgage over to a new property and take out another mortgage on top of that if you're, you know, going into a bigger home? So that's something else that you need to consider. But I can totally see why people like that stability. But again, I would say in the last 5 years, Jordan, the amount of times I thought the market has bottomed out, and I thought, you know, mortgage rates can't get any lower than this. And then, you know, lo and behold, another lower rate comes out. And I think also that 5-year thing, people like to perhaps pay their mortgage. So again, that's something else you need to consider when you're looking at taking out mortgage or remortgaging, is if you are in the market to overpay, how much you can, if you can overpay, and how much you can overpay by. Usually it's like a set 10%. And people, I think, have this notion of liking to be able to chip away at the mortgage and try and get as low LTV when they remortgage as possible, because you're going to get much better rates if you can get 60% LTV. You know, the rates that are available from someone with 90% LTV to 60% LTV is actually quite, you know, the gap is big at the moment. So I think a lot of people are liking trying to get into that. And the other thing to think about with rates as well, not just base rate, but banks and building sites are sitting on absolute tranches of cash. There is so much money floating around from various government schemes, but, you know, savers as well. The amount of money that has poured into banks, building societies in the last 18 months from the lockdown effect has been huge. So, you know, realistically, I can't see mortgage rates going, you know, all of a sudden mortgage rates are just going up and up and up and up. You know, we all have, when lenders lend money, you know, they stress test various scenarios. So if, you know, rates did go up to, I think it's 7%, you know, that feels like a very long way away. But, you know, going back to thinking about this energy crisis in the last month, things can change pretty quickly. So on one hand, I can see why people like the stability, you know, rates are low, go for it. On the other hand, they're not as flexible as something like a tracker mortgage. There's all sorts of things to consider and look into. And actually, if you do look in, if you are remortgaging, for example, you can start looking 6 months ahead of your deal expiring. So you can go and have a look. And if there's something that's actually way lower because perhaps you've built up equity in your home, or just perhaps rates have just come down from the last time you remortgaged, you can always go for that rate. And if it changes in the meantime, if it goes any lower, you know, usually lenders will honour it and let you go on to that lower deal. And actually, I mentioned that because we had a reader write in, I think maybe about 6 weeks ago, and listened to the podcast and said we helped save them about $4,000 or $5,000 because they'd heard the podcast. Well, yeah,
us,
just, you know, just general gassing, just general gassing on about personal finances. But, you know, kind of went and checked the rate since they started the process of remortgaging, and then realized the rate had gone down, and the lender honored the new lower rate, and it saved them, you know, X amount of money on their mortgage over the years. So there's lots of factors at play. as always, it always depends on your individual personal financial circumstances, of course. But, you know, there's so much to consider. And that's why I sometimes think if it's a bit overwhelming, a broker is there to help. And not just a broker, actually, I should add before I say that. I remortgaged earlier in the year, mm-hmm. and I spoke to a mortgage advisor on the phone with the bank that I'm with, and they were very, very helpful. I had a couple of questions. I was trying to get in my mind whether I wanted to remortgage and take 5 years off of the mortgage, or whether to stick with the same term and set up an overpayment. And the conversation I had was really, really helpful. So yeah. I would say there's a good level of expertise in banks and building societies that are there to help you.
Talking of overpayments, Helen, you've written an article about a new app. I want to talk about that for a second. It claims it can help you overpay. Who, what, and how?
Sure. So this app is called Sprive, and it's been founded by a guy called Janesh Vora. He's a former banker at Goldman Sachs, and basically it was inspired by his experience of wanting to overpay his mortgage, but finding the whole process quite confusing. So obviously overpaying your mortgage is something that your bank kind of doesn't really want you to do, because if you pay off your mortgage quicker, then obviously you're paying less interest. So they don't make the process necessarily particularly easy. So the idea of this app is it wants to kind of demystify that. So the first thing it does is it calculates the overpayments that you can afford to pay every month. So you sign up to them with sort of open banking, share your bank details with them, similar to the way that savings apps work. So things like Plum, you know, they track what you're spending and put away a certain amount for you every month. It works in the same way, but instead of putting the money away, you're overpaying that money into your mortgage. So it does that for you. The other thing it does is it helps you to calculate where you're at with your mortgage. So how much of your home you own as a percentage, how much you pay each month, and how the impact of the overpaying will have on your mortgage term. So sounds like something that would be really helpful, just if nothing else, just to get a handle on where you're at with things and to work out the impact that overpaying would have for your personal circumstances.
Which is a good point, because then it's the question, Helen, what do you need to think about when you're weighing up, should I overpay my mortgage or ... lots of other alternatives that you can think about with all the things that we need to spend our money on. I know, let's throw pensions into the mix, everything. Should I overpay my mortgage?
You're exactly right. So the first thing you always want to prioritise is any other kind of higher interest debts, you know, before you get into overpaying your mortgage. If you've got other things that are higher priority, obviously, start with those. Your pension also is another good place to put your money. Maybe if you're kind of getting close to retirement, or if you don't have a big pension, that's something else to think about putting your money into, perhaps before you start overpaying your mortgage. And also just generally having a bit of a savings sort of buffer, especially, you know, as Lee mentioned earlier, with the kind of cost of things going up fairly dramatically in the last few months, you know, people do still need to have some money squirreled away for those sort of, you know, unexpected bill rises and, you know, just a kind of a rainy day fund. You know, you don't want to put all of your money into being mortgage free. I mean, it's obviously tempting, because it's the dream for a lot of people, isn't it, to live mortgage free, but you know, don't do that at the expense of your financial security, I guess.
Yeah, take a holistic view. Before we put this to bed, this specific topic, not housing generally, because we're going to discuss a little bit more, but the 10-yearly, you spoke about the two, you spoke about the five. I mean, there is obviously must be a reason why you would want to fix for 10 years. Why would you want to fix for 10 years?
Yeah, this is a tricky one, George, if I'm being honest. I get nervous when we talk about any kind of financial product like this over a five-year term. And when I say financial product, I mean mortgages and I mean savings. When you start going beyond the five-year horizon, that feels like quite a long way away. And the fixing for 10 years could be tempting for some, because again, it's about that stability of thinking, well, that is how much I've got to pay in the next 10 years to be wherever it is in life. And I can imagine perhaps I hate the term forever home. Don't you know, I hate forever home. I'm moving into my forever home. But casting that aside, some people may, you know, get 2, 3, 4 moves in and then say, this is where we want to be for the foreseeable. We've got no plans. Perhaps, you know, you've got older children. Perhaps you're just in a place in your life where you're just not looking to move again. And let's say you're in your 40s or something and you're thinking 10-year plan to get this paid off. I can imagine that having that stability and having gone through things like a financial crisis where we saw things like negative equity and all that kind of stuff, people like to have, maybe some, like I say people, some people like to have a plan of how they could potentially become mortgage free, as Helen said there. And the rates on these types of products have come down massively. So there's still quite a niche product. You know, I wouldn't say that there's loads of lenders that are doing these, but repayment charges on these can be huge and things can change very, very quickly within a decade. A decade is a long time, isn't it? It really is a long time. I mean, it wasn't even 10 years ago when the London Olympics was on, for example, and that feels like it was a whole lifetime away. So what you really, really got to tread cautiously with these types of products, because it's just a long way away. And again, like I said earlier, you need to check all the T's and C's on this. And, you know, if you do want to overpay, for example, what's it going to, can you, you know, what are the early repayment charges? It's a niche product for a reason. And I think if you look to the stats, not many people choose to fix a mortgage for 10 years. And actually the other thing you do, you do sidestep potentially hefty fees. So when you do take out a 2-year fix, for example, and you got a fairly sizable fee on it, and then you need to do it again after another 2 years remortgage, and then you take another 2-year fix, fees actually can start to add on like quite a large sum. And I think a lot of people kind of might fall into that trap of that fee being sucked, like absorbed into their mortgage, so they don't really think about it too much. But that's why we have a true cost of mortgage calculator on our website, where you can go and work these things out. And again, this is why potentially it's worth talking to a broker and or a mortgage advisor at a bank or building site who can help you, guide you through these kind of figures. Because let's face it, having a mortgage is probably going to be the biggest outlay ever going to have. So you should really, really take your time to think about it, because the home buying process is stressful. And I think a lot of people kind of get all consumed by obviously finding a property in the first place, which is very difficult, and it's been difficult in a hot market. And then it's the thought of moving and perhaps getting stuff packed up and all of that kind of stuff. Sometimes then getting a mortgage is almost like an aside. You know, it's almost like, well, I can get a mortgage, I've got X deposit, I can get X rate. And then that's kind of it. You kind of palm it to the side because it feels boring. But it's a huge outlay. It's a huge outlay. If you're buying a home for 300 grand, if you're buying a home for 600 grand, it's a huge outlay. So you should really be taking as much time as anything else getting everything right.
Indeed. Good advice, Lee. From homeowners to landlords, this is an interesting angle this week. Buy-to-let landlords can now get their hands on a sub 1% mortgage after not one but two lenders cut their rates. Now, homeowners have seen these kind of deals around for a while. We've spoken about it on the pod. This is the first time, though, landlords have been able to get in on the action. Helen, just let's go back a step. Why is this so significant? What's the difference between a landlord's mortgage and a homeowner's mortgage? And why would a homeowner's be less than a landlord's?
I think it's just a risk thing from the banks. A home that you're not actually living in is more risky from a lending perspective than a home that you are living in. Obviously, you know, typically people generally sort of look after their home. It's like Lee said, it's their biggest asset. But if you're buying a home and you're not living in that home, then that obviously comes with more risk. So that's why the rates are generally higher.
So what are we seeing at the moment? Who are these two lenders? What are they offering? What do you need to look out for?
Sure. So as we've said, homeowners have been enjoying super, super low rates for quite some time. This is really the first time that landlords have been able to get in on that sub 1% action. So basically banks have, in many cases, gone kind of as low as they can go with homeowner mortgages. They're now having to, choosing to give those rates to landlords as well. So the Mortgage Works, which is the buy-to-let arm of Nationwide, they've come in with a rate of 0.99%. That's for people with a 35% deposit on a 2-year fix. almost matching that is Platform, which is the buy-to-let arm of the Co-op Bank. They've come in with a 1% rate. That's for people with a 40% deposit, also on a 2-year fix. So two very, very, very low rates for landlords there.
Lee, what's the landlord market looking like, the rental market looking like from a landlord's perspective? We're going to be talking about the tenants in a short while. But what about the landlord? Is it still worth it, buy to let?
Oh, that's a loaded question, Georgie. That's a very difficult question to answer. And it depends on who you ask. I think existing landlords have had it quite difficult in the last couple of years compared to previous years. There's things that are coming into play, such as energy efficiency ratings, which we've spoken about on this podcast before, coming in, where, you know, certain criteria need to be met. And that comes with all kinds of costs. It comes with all kinds of problems, such as where does a tenant go when you're doing these kind of works. Then we've had the tax side of things. You know, that's not as as generous as it once was. And the pandemic has kind of had a bit of a shift in renter behaviour. So there was some stats out this week. Urban areas are still growing a little bit of interest. So when I say urban areas, we're thinking about, you know, the big cities like London and Birmingham and Manchester and Edinburgh and those kinds of places where young professionals, you know, usually would go and live because, you know, there's jobs on offer, more jobs on offer, higher wages, that kind of thing. But there's been a shift. This report, I can't remember, I think it was Rightmove. It was basically showing that there was double digit growth in renting in rural areas and growing in sort of suburbs. But that's still at quite a low, you know, percentage compared to urban areas. So that's the thing, like, even though there has been growth, it's still nowhere near the sort of figures that you see people renting in the cities. And it seems to me like people are willing now to move back into cities again, that kind of thing. You know, people start to go back into the office more. Mm. You get that kind of feeling that's where things are heading. And actually, you know, there's nowhere near as many rental properties when you start coming out of the cities. You know, I live in a fairly sizable town in Essex, and there's not much in the way of rentals around here. You know, it takes a certain kind of family, for example, to be renting a 3 or 4 bedroom house. It might be that they're renting with a view to buy in the near future, and they're kind of almost like road testing the area. But if you start renting and then you do work in London, for example, from here, you know, you've got rents that are high. You've got, because rents have still held up. It's not like the rental market's collapsed. It's not like, you know, rents all of a sudden have got cheap. That it's still, the demand is still there. And as more landlords seem to be exiting the market, it's that kind of supply and demand issue. But then, you know, if you're commuting into London, all of a sudden that's basically all of your wages soaked up on overheads, you know. So it's all of those things at play. And landlords are, I think, it's become more difficult. They're more squeezed. You know, we've also had higher house prices, and not just in certain pockets of the area, but basically the whole country. You know, maybe not so much London, but elsewhere, you know, there's been double digit growth in all sorts of areas. Yeah. And that starts squeezing yields, and that it's just not as generous. It's not as easy to be a landlord.
No, indeed. I mean, talking about those house prices, I mean, thank goodness for London. How much more could it realistically go up by? We have seen house prices rising. I know you feel like everybody who's listening that I say that most months, and that is because that is mostly true. But we are saying it again because it's true again. Surprise, surprise. They're going at a fair clip. Apparently, still a lot to do with this race for space, Lee. So while people might be wanting to move back to the city, they do want to be suburb, I'd say. Like, when I think of rural, I think of, well, where I am at the moment in Yorkshire, North Yorkshire. But this is to be close to a city, and it makes sense. And I am actually in this boat, because there's an article on your website talking about rural renters and how much they're having to pay extra, around 11% extra. City, it's about 3%. It's going up by... I can speak from personal experience here, because I'm looking to move down to what would be a suburby area of London, a little bit further out. It's in Surrey, close to the family. There is absolutely nothing. And I have seen instances where a house or a cottage has been on Rightmove, for example. It's then disappeared and come back later a fair whack more expensive. And the sad reality is, when I've seen people complain about it on, you know, Facebook pages of that local area, everybody's saying, well, that's how much you have to pay in this area. That may be true, but still depressing when you think what I am expected to pay anyway down south would be double what I'm currently paying at north. Cannot find anything at the moment. It is a worrying situation for many people, Lee. What are we going to do about it? Am I going to find my house down south? I should hope so, because I've told the people up north I want to move.
It's a classic supply and demand issue, isn't it? You know, if you start having more people going into the rental market in areas that perhaps there hasn't been as strong rental demand as before, you know, you're going to have people fighting for the same property. And that's a scenario that I think all three of us on this podcast have been in it previously, you know, renting in London. It's an absolute dogfight to get a place that's good, because, you know, you go and visit somewhere and you think, this is nice. But for everyone that you visit that's nice, you visit one that is an absolute hellhole and you think, I wouldn't move there. And it becomes quite difficult to find somewhere nice to live. And that's the thing about the suburbs and you say about rural areas. But, you know, we say rural areas, there's plenty of Essex, for example, is rural, plenty of Surrey is rural, but still within sort of 45 minutes of London. So those places are really, really sought after at the moment, because people do want that space. They want a garden now. It's become, you know, more important than perhaps location. You always said location, location, location. Well, location is still important, but I think people are after more space. And the thing is, we build homes in this country. You know, there's a lot of apartments going up in London where basically you couldn't really swing a cat. And then we've got lots of new build homes that are being built, you know, in all sorts of periphery towns that really, when you look at the floor space, isn't that great. You know, we're not building homes that now people want with more space and modest gardens and all of that kind of thing. Yeah. And I think it reflects in this house price story from Halifax that I included in the podcast today, because I was actually quite taken away by the fact that property prices are still rising. I mean, I just keep thinking, when's it going to start slowing down a bit? Yeah. And then you get some data out saying that prices are up $4,500 in a month between August and September. In a month, $4,500.
It's ridiculous. When you're looking for something, like you were saying about London, I'm looking for things at the moment. If anything has a garden and a parking space, it's gone.
It's gone.
As soon as they say that they've got a house viewing and it's booking up, it's gone. It's gone. Within a couple of days, it's gone. Helen, give us some good news, please. Me.
I don't know if I have any.
No one's listening, by the way, and is a landlord and has a really lovely place down south near Surrey, or in Surrey, rather. You know, just feel free to get in contact with me about it. Helen?
Anytime. The whole thing has gone kind of slightly mad, hasn't it? I think perhaps we will see house prices come down in the near future. There's potentially some good news for people who are looking to move. I think obviously the stamp duty holiday has only just fully gone away. It ended finally at the end of September. So we haven't really seen the impact of that come through in the figures yet. And I think, you know, just generally, people sort of felt quite rich during the pandemic, or some sort of sections of the population felt quite rich during the pandemic. You know, people were able to sort of build up a lot of savings. And I think maybe the impact that that's had on people's desire to move house has been a bit underestimated. I think now with inflation going up and the cost of living going up, I think people are feeling the strain a little bit, and I think that might ultimately start to nip these mad house prices in the bud.
Let's hope so. As you were talking there, I've got a website up, Rightmove website, and I was just popping on there to see if any of the changes had happened. You know, and I'm reading something here. I don't think I've ever read anything like this before. A realistically priced 2-double-bedroom furnished semi-detached house. What does realistically priced mean? As in, it's realistically priced for the area, or it's a complete whole and it's realistically priced because it's quite cheap. Lee, actually, you wanted to be a estate agent. What would you have put there? What do you take as realistically priced?
Can we just rewind on Lee? You wanted to be an estate agent.
Sorry, I have to say that every episode. You did, Lee. You did. When I was growing up, I wanted to be an astronaut or an Olympic runner, Lee. You wanted to be an estate agent.
It was a profession.
You're closer, to be fair, to your dreams than I am.
I was brought up on a diet of sort of those kind of house programs, you know, that your mum used to make you watch, like Changing Rooms and things, and thought, I'm actually quite nosy. I quite like, that's why I'm a journalist, right? But that's why I quite like, you know, looking around people's homes and all that kind of thing. And yeah, we won't go back down that rabbit hole.
No, but sorry.
Price is just a sales technique to say, you know, that's a mind trick, isn't it? Oh, so it's reasonably priced. Oh, okay. That's
realistically priced, though. It's low, so it makes me think it's not a nice place, and they have just realistically priced it rather than paying too much for the area. Anyway, I'm not sure what that means.
You go turn up, and if it's not realistically priced for Georgie, you say, this is not realistically priced for Georgie, and I will offer you X amount of money. How do you like those onions?
Yeah, the way things are going at the moment, I've got no chance. But anyway, we're going to put this to one side. I'm going to focus on a reader letter. It's about premium bonds. I've rather enjoyed this, I have to say. I've held a sizable sum in premium bonds with NS&I for the best part of two decades. The returns I've had are modest. The odd tiny prize win here and there. I was wondering if I should sell my bonds and start again. It feels like newer numbers seem to be luckier. For example, I noticed in the last draw that the two £1 million jackpot winners both had purchased their bonds in 2021. Is there any benefit of cashing out my old bonds to refresh them? Can you imagine if they came in the week after? Is this true? Are newer numbers luckier?
Do you want the long answer or do you want the short answer, Georgie? Because the short answer is no.
Okay, there we go.
Every £1 bond has the same chance of winning as another £1 bond. But what's happened in the two decades, in the last sort of 20 years, is a couple of things have come into play, which probably makes people feel like this, right? So first of all, people can pour much more cash into premium bonds than they could previously. So you can put up to 50 grand in them now. So basically, that means that if you max it out, which we've done some research before on this, and there is actually quite a lot of people that max them out, you know, that just means they've got more bonds. They've got more of a chance of winning. And that's the way, you know, that kind of goes. But also, we're on the back of some absolutely crazy figures that Ed Magnus, our savings reporter, got from this, which I found it really interesting actually. So it was all about when bonds were bought, right? So pre-2000, in the September 2021 draw, so bonds that were bought pre-2000 made up 2.7% of the draw, which is incredible because premium bonds have been around since the late 50s. Only 2.7% of bonds that were in the most recent draw were bought basically in 40 odd years. Between 2000 and 2009, that's 12%. So even that doesn't feel that high. Then you go into 2010, 2019, which was when we saw the uplift to 50 grand. And perhaps we've seen rates, especially things like easy access, just fall off a cliff. So people have got more interested in the underlying rate from premium bonds and that potential to win big. We've spoken about this before. People love that kind of bit of a flutter, but also knowing that they can pull their money out anytime. It's not like playing a lottery where you've lost your stake, which is a good point on the Euro Millions day today, where we've got the biggest jackpot, you know, ever. You know, it's not quite the same thing, but 48.5% of bonds that were in the most recent draw were bought between 2010 and 2019. But astonishingly, since the start of 2020 and today, 36.9% of bonds that were in the most recent draw have been bought basically in the last 18 months, which shows you that pandemic effect and how mad that is. But in that same breath, in this same table that premium NS&I gave to us, which was very kind of them, the percentages of prizes that were paid in September 2021 draw, pre-2000, 2.7%. So exactly the same amount of prizes. So that is exactly where you'd expect it to be. 2000, 2009, 12.3%. Again, pretty much exactly, you know, as you would expect it. 2010 to 2019, 50.2%. So slightly luckier if you bought them then. I need just a smidgen. And then 2020 to now, 34.8%. So the breakdown of that of the prizes that were given out in September 2021 are exactly how you would expect them from how the bonds, when the bonds were bought. And then, you know, rightly pointed out this month, this year, so the last draw, both of the bonds that won the £1 million jackpot were bought this year. But that's not really that unusual when you consider almost two-fifths of premium bonds that were in the most recent draw were bought in the last 18 months. I think there are astonishing stats, and it really actually highlights how much money has gone into premium bonds in the pandemic.
Is the point then, Helen, like Lee said, the short answer was no, new numbers aren't luckier. Is it the fact that this is a sizable sum in premium bonds that could actually be better placed elsewhere?
Yeah, of course. I mean, the premium bonds kind of phenomenon is quite interesting. They're extremely popular. And it is, it's essentially a lottery. I mean, but with savings rates so low elsewhere, I think people just feel at the minute, you know, why not? You've got a chance of winning a fair whack of cash. And if the other option is to have your money in a savings account earning like 0.4% interest, then, you know, why not? When rates start to go up, I mean, I think people might do well to kind of have a look at kind of putting their money elsewhere. But I mean, also, you know, it's not just about savings. I mean, the money might well be better kind of invested if that's something you're comfortable with doing, or again, sort of put into your pension, paid off your house. I mean, there are probably for some people better things you can do with your money, but it kind of depends on your own circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely. Finally, if someone were to ask me to guess the most read article, I believe you, Lee, because you told me this is true, on This Is Money's website this week, I would not guess it in a million years. But then again, I have to say, I can't say that becoming a long distance lorry driver has ever really appealed to me. Although looking at some of the sums talked about at the moment, maybe. So it's the article, I'm thinking of becoming an HGV driver. What training do I need? How much does it cost? And can I really earn a big salary and bonuses? You really do cover it all. So I love This Is Money. Honestly, I really do. Lee, Helen, do you fancy becoming an HGV driver?
I'm like you, George. I can't believe this has been the most read story on our website in the last week. But that goes to show their interest in this and what's been going on. And actually, I think there's a kind of thing at play here where people don't actually know what it takes to be an HGV driver, and kind of, you know, the hard work that goes into it. And obviously it's become one of the forefront issues of recent times, which, you know, just still feels quite bonkers to say. And it's like, I think I mentioned this on the podcast recently, like, we've just woken up and realized how important, you know, lorry drivers are to being the backbone of this country and getting things moving, and the supply and, you know, issues. And it's hard work. This story was interesting because it showed a few things, and one of those was an actual tangible amount of money that you could reasonably expect to earn as a kind of first-time HGV driver, and actually 35 to 50 grand. And there's lots of bonus payments out there at the moment. There's lots of companies that are trying to poach drivers from other companies and offering the world, because if you're a company that relies on getting your product into retailers, for example, and you've got your said product stuck in a warehouse because you don't have people to go and drive it off and then go and sell the product, you know, you've got serious problems. So you're kind of at the mercy of HGV drivers at the moment. And let's face it, not having the actual right license, there's not that many people that will have the required level, and they've become very highly sought after, skilled individuals that you know, companies want. And there was a great Twitter thread recently. I can't remember who it was, but it was like a day in the life of a lorry driver, and it was really interesting about how they go about their day, and, you know, the breaks, you know, having to have mandatory breaks and where they could take them, how they unload products and then take on like old stuff to take away and how they stack it and all that kind of stuff. And it was really fascinating insight into a day of an HGV driver. And wages have gone up almost 13% between February and August, which shows that the kind of level, the scale of the problem, and throwing money after it to get the people that you need. So in this story, we try to not go into the weeds too much. And we you know, because there's lots of technicalities of, you know, having a license where you can carry a lorry load over a certain kg and all of that kind of thing. And we did go down a little bit of that route, but you have, when you look at the back of your driving license, you can see, you know, the different levels and different grades of license that you can have. And it will show you if you want to get, you know, lorry license, you need, I think it's a C&E license, and what you've got to do that. And actually the government have been talking about, you know, you can do like an online course, potentially. There's been a big backlog of driving licenses in general. I mean, we get so many readers writing in, you know, just for general driving licenses, and they're having to wait for months to have a practical test. And it's the same when it comes to lorry drivers as well, which has helped, you know, exacerbate the problem. So yeah, it's definitely an interesting area. I can see why people have been interested in it. And if you are someone that's perhaps looking for a career change, or perhaps you're sort of semi-retired, or, you know, perhaps you're just after making a bit of cash and going into an industry where you think, well, I could be quite good at that, and, you know, maybe I'll do it for a couple of years and take these kind of higher salaries while they're on offer and see what it's all about. Because I think, again, I was saying this in the podcast recently, Georgie, how many people come out of school or go to university and think, oh, I'm going to be an HGV driver? You know, it's again one of those industries which just hasn't been very fashionable. People think of long hours, they think of driving overnight, they think of all these kind of things. And it's not given as a kind of solid career move for perhaps an 18-year-old or a 21-year-old. You know, but now the reality is, we're crying out for these people. We're crying out for these drivers. And I know it's a little bit difficult because it's when you're 18, 21, you don't really have the driving experience to be, you know, taking on a huge lorry load like that. But there's no harm in, you know, starting on a smaller kind of van, for example, and then slowly learning it over time for it to then be a career. But yeah, it's one of those things. It's not just lorry drivers. I think there's a number of industries that are just almost like a call to arms is needed for some of these industries, and to make them more fashionable to, you know, children, kids at school and perhaps not going off to university, but rather doing apprenticeships and that kind of thing.
You say that, Lee, but I remember being at school and we had a substitute religious studies teacher. I can't remember her name, Miss somebody. Anyway, little lady, fairly elderly, but then, you know, I say fairly elderly, I was like, what, 13? She was probably only about 30. And she always said that her dream was to be a long distance lorry driver. I don't know if she said that after a class with us and just dreamed of getting the heck away from us. That could have been it. But, you know, my mind was opened then, Lee, at the tender age of some teenage thing.
But that's the thing as well, Georgie, actually, it's a good point. You know, how many women are in the industry? How many women have been attracted into becoming lorry drivers? It carries a certain kind of, you know, not a stigma, because that's not the right word, but, you know, I don't feel like it's really been opened up to, you know, everyone, if that makes sense. You kind of know what I'm getting at. It's kind of there needs to be more done to attract next generation of these kind of roles, in my mind, but it's easy to say these things. It's easier said than done.
Yeah I mean, you can listen to podcasts like this one. Why would you not want it, Helen? Fancy it?
Not a career choice for me. No? I think possibly. So I actually have a bit of insight into this. So my mum's partner is a lorry driver. He's semi-retired, so he does it sort of contract basis. He can kind of pick and choose what jobs he takes. The thing that always astounds me is the huge amount of patience that you need to be a lorry driver. So much of his job is just waiting around, like waiting for people to get their shipments ready, waiting to find somewhere to park, waiting for someone to let him into a depot.
Is he the most patient man you know?
He's extremely patient.
Yeah.
I mean, he loves it because he loves driving, and he's the sort of person that will like chew your ear off about traffic on the M4. Like he absolutely loves driving. But yeah, it's it's a hard job though. Mm. You're so right. It's, you know, it's long hours, and you know, it's a skilled job to do something like that. But he's yeah, obviously people are absolutely biting his hand off to.
I was gonna say, is he coming back? Is he working more?
Yeah, he's having a good time. But it is, yeah, I think people underestimate the kind of tedium of being a lorry driver.
You have to like your own company, I'd imagine.
You really do. Yeah.
And driving.
He actually he's asked my mum to go along with him on long drives.
Oh, romantic.
As a passenger, and she's so far refused.
Oh, what a shame. She's got a real insight.
Quite sweet.
Write an article about it.
Yeah, I should. But it's definitely it's an interesting career choice, but obviously very very lucrative at the minute, it sounds.
Admit it, Lee. I've given you a story idea there, haven't I?
Yeah, I could feel the light.
I can see your face. Like, yeah, well, great idea.
I think 48 hours with a lorry driver to find out the real tedium of it will make not a tedious article, but something I think people will want to read. I mean, looking at the reader stats for this story, I mean, it all makes
exactly right.
I want to know how much money he's being offered. You know, our company's like falling over him, you know, and I want to know what it's like to be on a really high up cab, feeling like king of the road. And, you know, what goes on? I'm interested. I am. Helen, you're going to do it.
Honestly, it's a winner. Right, that's it for this week. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, or perhaps you could invite one of them along on your long-distance lorry drive. Lee?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can always follow us on Twitter as well, @thisismoney. And you can also go onto the article which this podcast is published on, and you can go into the reader comments there and tell us all about your lorry driving experiences or whether you're fixed for 10 years. We'd love to hear from you, so please do.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.